So there's no regulation on how much they can charge you. They can charge you anything. So there's daycare, you know, I don't know what the average is, but it's easy to find a elder care facility, a nursing home, they used to call them, that charges like $14,000 a month. Who has $14,000 a month among the working class? Almost no one. So what happens is very quickly, the life savings of the person, the elderly person, is gone. And they're thrown onto Medicare, Medicaid. And whether or not that nursing home takes Medicare, they have to find a place that takes Medicare and Medicaid. This is if their relatives can't take care of them and some are too sick, obviously, to be taken care of by relatives. So then it's just downward spiral. And I think I've told this story before about my own family. We were pretty typical, both good and bad. Our father was becoming progressively ill and getting into his 80s. And I had tried to raise the subject, but I'm not blameless here either, of the stuff you have to do to get out of a nursing home, stealing all the assets of the person in it. And I think then you're liable, maybe in some cases, for payment as well. The only regulation that we found out was that for the first 21 days of a nursing home stay, they can't make you pay for that. And I'm not sure if that's a Medicaid thing or what. So our father got sick and went to the hospital. Now hospital's trying to kick you out fast. So they kicked him out pretty fast. He was only there a couple of days. He wasn't feeling well still. Ends up in a nursing home, and the clock is now ticking. And all my attempts to get my brother and others to pay attention to this and develop a plan, which isn't easy to do because you have to go to a lawyer, pay a lot of money, and hide money in a trust and do all this other crap. And you have to do it like 5 years before the nursing home stay. A lot of people can't afford that and can't get their act together. And we were included in that group, unfortunately. So I'm sitting there trying to say at the last minute, look, this is really, really going to screw us, you know. And no one wanted to talk about it, so I shut up too. Like a lot of working class people, what stuff happens, it's just going to happen, you know. My father somehow must have understood. I mean, he didn't have dementia or anything, but he wasn't thinking about this stuff that much either. But he must have understood at some level what was going on because he stayed in this nursing home like 20 days. And then the management and a doctor that was a tool for them kept trying to convince him and us that he should stay longer. And he's like, no, sorry, I'm out of here. And we're like, oh, okay. So we take him out.
So he doesn't have to pay.
We didn't have to pay.
He knew, okay.
He knew what the rule was.
I'm out of here 21, day 21.
Day, yes.
All right.
Exactly. So
that's
he knew, he also hated it there, so it was a combination of things, but he knew the rule, right? So we bring him home, and he's, you know, getting older. He's got a lot of chronic health things, so he goes on hospice. You ever hear of hospice?
Is it a hospital? No.
No, hospice is a thing that basically is trying to set you up to die, and that is often subsidized. I don't remember that we had to pay for that, so a hospice is like they will give you, they'll bring a nurse to come and see you at home or some healthcare worker. They'll do like chores that you can't do anymore because you're elderly, but that allows you to stay at home. Mm-hmm. Like in my father's case, they got brought in a special bed, a special chair that we couldn't afford. And so he got that stuff. All this stuff was really positive and good, and I don't think we were paying for it. I'm not sure about the nurse thing, though. I think we would have had to pay for that. So my father starts getting better. He starts actually improving because of all this attention, you know? And they even brought in, like, a minister or something, you know, and all this to, like, counsel him and stuff. So he's getting all this attention and stuff. And meanwhile, my family has to just work all the time. They can't take care of him. And he's not in this nursing home where they rip off all his money, which was very little, but there was some savings, right, from his years of working. He had a pension and everything. And so he's basically, like, getting better, and they don't like that. See, the hospice thing is for when you're dying. So they started to take everything away. Like, oh, we're going to come and get the chair. Oh, I like that chair. Sorry. Boom. Take the bed. They're not going to come in and do your dishes or your shopping anymore. See you later. You know? And I don't blame the hospice thing that much for it, but I kind of think that it is an example of, because the stuff was free before that. But it shows you how crazy and insane healthcare is in this country. You know? We're going to find a way to screw you out of every penny you own, and you're going to go bankrupt, or you're going to die. Maybe we'll help you a little bit with the dying, but not too much. So he starts getting better. And then he starts getting worse again. A couple of things came back, not everything. And unfortunately, you know, eventually passed away. This was just so irritating, you know?
Death by capitalism.
Death by capitalism, 1, definitely. 000. Oh, I have another ex-girlfriend of mine when we were going out. Her, this is back in the 80s, 90s, I think. Her, 80s, I think. One of her elderly aunts went to the hospital, a hospital in Concord for pneumonia, right? And, you know, this is like at a time when they're starting to cut back on healthcare and stuff. So they shoved her in a hallway instead of putting her in a room and taking care of her. And she died. I call that death by capitalism, too. You get shoved into a hallway when you're supposed to be in a room where they're taking care of you. I mean, what the hell? And there's a lot of examples. Everyone, talk to any American and really deeply, and most of them, unless they're rich, they're going to have some story like that, I think, you know, of something that didn't go well with the medical care, because it's just like avoiding medical care. Like, how many people, I mean, we do this all the time, right? We don't go in for stuff to avoid the copays and the rest of it, you know?
Yeah. Unless it's very painful.
Unless it's an emergency, yeah. But anyway, even that is, you get screwed on that really bad. Emergency things. Anyway, the original point was elderly care, elder care is out of control, just like child care in this country. And of course, women live longer than men. This is and if you want to look at it that way, a women's issue, and to a certain extent, and like, where is anyone talking about that? You know, they it's just not being talked about. And I tried to do some research about when did all that deregulation kick in, and I think it was during the Carter administration. It really started, and then just got worse. So all the cities are like. Like in Boston, I remember down like Alston, there'd be like all these nursing homes that were run by the city. They're gone now, most of them. They're gone. You know?
Oh, now that Harvard took over Alston.
Not even that part of Alston. I don't even mean that part. I mean like down the other way, like, you know, near...
Brighton?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Alston, yeah. Brighton more, yeah. Anyway, you get the point, I think, that... you know, a lot of the repression and oppression is based in economic reality under capitalism that will not solve itself. It's going to take conscious fighting to get social benefits even under capitalism, but more to the point, getting rid of the problem itself. So countries where they have achieved national health care, right, in Britain, we've made this point before, but it's very, very true. It gets so popular that even the conservatives, even the pro-capitalist politicians are afraid to attack it head on, openly. But secretly, like Boris Johnson, those people, Boris Johnson even said, we'll put more money into NHS. Meanwhile, that's NHS means National Health Service. Meanwhile, they cut wherever they can. They defund wherever they can. They set up private parallel institutions and that the rich can go to. You know, it's really nasty. And the reason I mention that is you don't win the fight by winning a reform. You get a temporary amelioration of the problem, which is good. We want whatever makes working people's lives better, but we have to be honest and say your life's only going to be better for a little bit. And as far as your children go, or even you go later on, all bets are off under capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
You're not gonna keep that benefit. Anyway, South Africa goes into other places where the CWI members have been fighting in England and Scotland and so on. In South Africa, CWI members have been at the forefront of a public sector workers movement demanding permanent jobs and a minimum wage of, I don't know what this would be in dollars, but Rand, 12,500 minimum wage, where the majority of the workforce are women in this particular sector. CWI members across the globe combine the struggle against women's oppression with the fight for all workers against austerity and cutbacks, and in mass campaigns for the building of new homes and new schools to relieve the daily pressures on their lives. That's what I was kind of getting at, you know, the material gains. It's also been clear that women as heads of government or any part of the capitalist world are no more likely than men to push through policies to alleviate the special problems of women. In Finland, all the main parties are led by women, but as a CW member in Helsinki writes, quote, none of them in government or in opposition has ever taken a strong stand against a capitalist or neoliberal economic policies that so damage the lives of working class women. And also in Finland, be immigrant women as well, obviously. In Latin America, pro-capitalist heads of state like Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, Cristina de Kirchner in Argentina, and now Jeanine Añez in Bolivia. That's the right winger, right? Mm-hmm. Añez, yeah. They have all presided over the implementation of viciously anti-working class policies, which make women's lives harder rather than easier. So just to use a rough analogy, when Warren dropped out of the Democratic Party primary, the corporate media, yeah, I hope they all drop out, but I hope Sanders drops out of the Democratic Party and helps organize a workers' party. He's in the wrong place if he really believes in that
Howard,
stuff.
I even called you because I was like, I remember Hawkins, and I was like, yeah.
Okay. Howie Hawkins, yeah.
That person. What is, I think it was J or G, he's like, he's independent. I'm like, yeah, just yell it out across the room. Thank you.
Well, I get that when I go in, and I went to make sure my voting stuff was in order. Not because I'm going to vote Democrat or Republican, but, you know, just make sure it was in order for voting for lefts or whatever. Yeah, I'm registered as a socialist in Massachusetts.
Oh, me too, socialist.
You have a designation of socialist, but whenever I go and they go, S? What's S? So they did that, like, in where I went to...
So I got
to
get that fixed, because mine was J or G.
Green, probably green if it's G.
Because last time I voted was for Jill Stein.
It's not really a registration. It's a... Well, okay, that might be registration, because that's a party that has a ballot line. But the political designation is on top of the registration. And it's just a weird Massachusetts thing. I think it might exist in other places where it's not what you're registered as. It's a political designation that you're allowed to say. And because the socialist, a group called the Socialist Party, way back, a small group in Massachusetts, like back in the 80s, got that on the ballot. It's a law in Massachusetts. So although I have nothing to do with that party, I'm registered. I'm not registered as, but I have political designation as a socialist. My whole point is that people say, S, what's S? I go, socialist. I say it really loud. And they're like, oh, okay.
Are you registered as a communist?
No.
That's illegal?
I can tell you why. No, it's not the state's fault in this case. Well, it might be. I don't know if the state would allow this, but once that political designation law came in, the Communist Party, as far as I know, never lifted a finger to try to, this tiny little fight. Communist Party, to try to get on, be part of that. They support Democrats all the time. Why would they do that? They're not communist in this country.
But as an individual, if I say to myself, my political conscience is communism.
That's not how the law works.
No?
The law is about established political designations that had got a certain number of signatures and... Uh-huh. Blah blah, you know. And once that happened, they got until someone tries to change that law. That's the law in Massachusetts. I'm not just defending it's virtually. Well, I think it's good. I like it because it lets you make a statement, but it doesn't mean much, you know. Nothing means anything politically in this country in terms of working people really improving their lives until we have some sort of workers' party, some sort of big mass socialist or labor or. Workers' party of some sort, as we've talked about many times on the show. So this article actually gets into now the U.S. a little bit. Talks about Trump, obviously states the obvious. Millions of people will be celebrating if Trump loses, but victory for the Democrats may not do what people want. Because the party remains committed to carrying out the dictates of Wall Street and big capital, and a Democratic president will frustrate the aspirations of men and women who vote for change. With the prospect of a deeper economic crisis unfolding in the course of this year in the U.S., in Europe, and internationally, the massive increases in public spending on welfare, health services, and education that are needed worldwide are not going to happen on the basis of capitalism. And this means that socialists who are concerned for the welfare of women across the globe have to build the forces for socialist change. So in this country, and I think that's implied there, add the coronavirus stuff. They're going to use that as an excuse to cut jobs. They already are, I think. They're going to use that as an excuse to really go after people and not question the healthcare problems that make it worse and all that. So anyway, there's the article goes on about the Me Too movement, putting that in perspective, and showing it's a welcome thing, especially when they put away someone like Harvey Weinstein. But there are all these struggles by women happening internationally and even in the U.S. that are not reported on. And by the corporate media and not talked about that much. I don't have time to go into that too much. Then it ends with a world to win. The right of women to freely choose when and whether to have children is denied them in every part of the world. It means fighting not only for abortion rights, as recently happened in Poland, Ireland, and Argentina, but also for free... Can you imagine, like, in this country, they still have abortion rights. Well, we barely have it here, actually. Fertility treatment and when and if necessary. It also depends on having the means available to house, feed, clothe, and educate children, literally from cradle to grave. Achieving all these advances demands resources far in excess of what a diseased capitalist system can provide. It demands a struggle for socialism, the fight to end the division of society into classes and the social classes, oppressed and oppressors, can never be seen as something separate and apart from the struggle to end women's oppression. It cannot be cross-class, and it must be meaning like you can't rely on the top bourgeois, you know, top rich women to lead the struggle. It cannot be cross-class, and it must be of working women and men together. If you agree with most of the ideas set out here, blah, blah, send your comments and questions. Join the CWI in the struggle for socialism worldwide. So I thought that was a really good article, again, by Claire Doyle of the Committee for Workers International. I'm going to maybe take a quick break because I want to get a drink. Yeah. My throat's a little dry. And we got number three up.
Decisions
yeah,
by
tell us about
Goody
this.
Mob.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we'll be right
a little
back.
Hip hop.
And you're listening to WMFO.org. And I'm using WMFO, which you can find at WMFO.org, although we had an earlier caller say that's not working today. Go to 91.5 FM over the air to listen. And hopefully, I don't know, we'll see. We'll see about the technical difficulties. And let's do some music and we'll be right back.
Oh, it's number three.
Attention!
Go to three.
The time has come.
Is that it or not?
No.
This one?
Next. Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Atlanta, gateway to the South.
An extremist, like a chemist, cooking up a plan like the witch doctor. So a shot like a 1,000 volts over the edge of the hope with the CIA selling coke to make they blow. Go up the river, King Louis, lick a sipper as I strategize a plan to infiltrate the crooked new world ways of living life. Who we got to fight to get it right? Are you down in
the relentless realism, regardless, represents Southwest skills I possess to manifest as heaven sent. What said is meant to the fullest extent. No nonsense, because my conscience wouldn't be content. But just a little wealth, a little fame, but your mind frame will keep you living the same. And it's a shame that niggas would settle with the ghetto. Holes at some clothes and ain't making what you suppose, cause your eyes closed to what your contract shows in fine print. They gotta get back every cent you spent. You content, cause you do what everybody does. The industry done changed from the person you was, knee deep in the struggle. Two part-time jobs to juggle. Got a lady and a seed that you can't hardly feed. In the day your life could end, so you depend on the reciting and the right when you got the spare time to spend to keep you stable, hoping one day you'll be able to be a commodity on somebody's record label. Got your chance, $20,000 advance and a car, and all of a sudden you a star at the bar balling, calling the waiter to bring one of their finest wines. Then you started snorting lines. Your life defines the misconception of staying down. You can't be influenced by everybody you hang around. You should have been more appreciative of the life that you were blessed to live. 100% is what you got to give, cause ain't no telling. Your bullshit starts smelling, and you wonder why your record ain't selling. No more, ended up with no dough, and no respect back in the projects, and building 23, right next door to me.
The battle's no longer physical, it's from within. You live to die, and you die to live again.
But you can't win for losing, what sides are you choosing?
Decisions to make. Decisions to make about your guts. See you up with what? Nothing but them good ass.
Yep.
Huh?
I think she's a regular.
She is.
And you can hear it outside, but faint. Not like a faint. No, no. Oh, okay. They probably shut. These kids are out there. They don't want to hear us.
Carrying the curses of history.
Is that you say every time they come in, they
the oil burns in thick black columns.
Well, they have it down, but they don't have it up.
They shout, give us that
gray morning to the south of here. Two young men in makeshift uniforms peer into the misty light. And yeah. figures dart behind the trees as a snap of rifle rounds echoes out across the fields. Well, they hardly know their secret mother tongue. Yeah, but they recognize the duty to defend the flag hanging limp and bloody above the village church. Well, 1,000 miles away, in a warehouse complex down by the river, none of those great stories someone's about serial killers. Dreams flow into savage toy. Cheer the sirens screaming out across the city. We had 3 odd nights in succession. The riot season is here again. Dear Lord, lead us back to the valley of the shadow.
Good, and then D-I-E, and then Mob is M-O-B-B.
So did you think we
decisions.
Were born in peaceful times? The whirling derby spinning around faster, faster. The center cannot hold. Like a whirling derby spinning, spinning faster. Ah, oh, the center cannot hold.
And that was New Model Army with Here Comes the War. I love that song. We play that song a lot. And I apologize if people get sick of that song.
They both have like a System of a Down type of...
Yeah, yeah. They're still around. They're an old punk band I saw.
System of a Down?
No. Oh. New Model Army.
Oh, okay.
It's still around. They're a punk band from the punk days. I saw them in the 80s at TT and the Bears. You know that place in Central Square that went out of business? Yep. And it was a great concert.
They just
great
changed
concert.
Names, that's all. They're still there. They just
They're
changed
still doing
names.
Music?
Yeah, they still do concerts, that. But it's a different name.
I had no idea.
The Middle East.
I went to that. And I'm thinking back, maybe it's kind of that like kind of nostalgia thing when you get older, but I saw a lot of good concerts that were small. You know?
Oh, and they're the best.
I kind of like that. I saw Warren Zevon in a gym in Oneonta Estate, New York, the college gym. Literally about 20 people there, and I'm right in front of the stage. I wonder what he thought. You know, who's this weird guy, weird kid staring at me from like 2-3 feet away or something, you know? But it was a good show. I mean, I admire the performers that still churn it out when there's no one there, you know? I don't really like this guy in some ways, like either his music or his persona, but Elvis Costello, I have to say, best concert I ever saw in terms of creativity. He did every song. He did a long concert first, almost like Bruce Springsteen-esque in terms of the length. This is in Cleveland back in like 81 or 2 or something. So he does every song. He's got out by then a couple albums worth of music, every song done differently than on the record. And usually people don't like that, including myself. They want to hear something familiar. But this was all really good. Like everything was different, but it was still really, really, really good. And then he does this long concert, and he's, you know, everyone thinks it's over finally, right? Some people are getting, they got to go. It was like a weekday night. And he does two encores, right? So, wow, that's even longer. And then they turn up the house lights. And who knows who turned up the house lights? If it was he wanted that or didn't want that, because everyone starts filing out. Me and my friends are still sitting there talking about the concert. Our minds were like blown by this concert. And he comes running out with the house lights up, grabs his guitar and starts playing an acoustic or something. I think he plugged it in, but he's playing like another song. And we're like, oh my God. And people start running in from the hallways. I don't know. Do people still do that stuff? I mean, I don't know. I haven't been to a concert in so long. So, but it was great. Hey, what was the Goody Mob song called again?
Decisions.
Okay, thanks. And yeah, and Goody Mob's the composer. We'll call that.
Group, yeah.
Yeah, sorry for people, our listeners listening to this techno speak here, but we have to record certain things. What was the name of the album?
Soul Assassins.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, and I'm sorry for that. For
it's
everybody.
Actually a collaboration. There's a lot of different groups in this
album. Yeah, yeah, I know. Yeah, yeah. So it looks really good, and I've heard of it, of course, but
DJ Muggs, the DJ, the producer of Cypress Hill.
Yep. So, continuing with the International Women's Day thing a little bit here, we're running out of time. Boy, you look at the, like, if you ask ask Diego, how big is this pile of papers I have here of stuff to, notes and stuff for this show?
Looks like my files.
That's a four-hour show. I did not use my editing skills here for today's show. So we're gonna speed things up. Teen Vogue. What do you think of when you hear Teen Vogue? I think of glossy teen magazine from the 80s or 70s, right?
I think Madonna.
Okay.
Now, like,
I get that. I get that.
Vogue.
Yeah, I get that. Well, it was a magazine and is a magazine. I don't know if it's still in print, but they certainly have a website. And people keep sharing with me on Facebook articles from Teen Vogue because they have a leftist slant on them. And I mean that in a good sense. They have some sort of something about socialism or something. Like, I'm going to refer to an article about Rosa Luxemburg here, and then it says, want more from Teen Vogue at the end? Check this out. What capitalism is and how it affects people. Okay, Teen Vogue.
Wow.
This is nice. This is great. I'm reading pretty good stuff from Teen Vogue
this
about socialism.
This is for the new millennials, too.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. So, and, you know, if you had to pick, I hate doing this because, you know, I think society is more complex than this, but if you had to separate out demographic groups, I'd say young women are possibly the most radical group out there in general, in a general sense. Exceptions, of course. And then, you know, and again, also the same problem with racial demographics. They're much more complicated in real life. But I think, you know, black workers and working people in general are a lot, despite this whole thing about Biden and all that, like this idea that, oh, black workers are conservative because they're voting for. Totally wrong. You don't understand. The average union member for a long time has been a black worker. There's just a consciousness there that keeps getting prodded, let's say, by capitalism to say, hey, things are not that good, obviously. You know, everything from the discussions around reparations to the police brutality to just, you know, next recession hits, how many more people are going to lose their homes and all that. So anyway, but, you know, young women, I think, are getting radicalized. This is International Women's Day. We've talked about some of the reasons why that would be already. Relatively low pay and things not changing in many places of the world as far as women being forced to do a lot of free labor. It's still true here in the U.S. as well. Anyway, here's an article, a very interesting article, and we don't have time to go into that much, but Rosa Luxemburg, who was the revolutionary socialist and author, and it's a pretty good introduction to Rosa Luxemburg. So, and this was not written on International Workers' Day, but just, I believe, on the 5th of March. So on March 5th, 1871, I believe it's March 5th, please check that, Rosa Luxemburg was born in Zamość, Poland. I don't know where that is, to a middle-class Jewish family living under Russian occupation. On January 15th, 1919, she was murdered and dumped in a Berlin canal by members of the Freikorps, irregular armed gangs acting as paramilitary allies of her former former members of the, she used to be in the German Social Democratic Party. From modest beginnings to a targeted assassination by the state, Luxembourg's path offers one of the most fascinating accounts of radical political agitation and economic theorizing in the history of, and then it's in parentheses, Jewish female revolutionaries. But did you ever come across her name in your high school textbook?
No.
No?
I came across her name on Kotsky, one of the Kotsky's book that I have.
That's interesting.
And he was in a Democratic, so that's
yeah,
where
was,
Lenin
yeah.
split with him because
that's the
of
party
his,
that because partially because of this, yeah,
because of his the Social Democrats were going with the war credits for World War I.
Exactly, and Luxembourg and Liebknecht for another Karl Liebknecht, a comrade of hers, they refused to go along with that.
Weren't they married?
I don't know.
I think they were husband and wife.
I don't know. But did you ever come across her name in your high school textbook? My answer is no also.
No.
Perhaps it was mentioned in your European history course. No. If Luxembourg's name isn't familiar to you, and I came across her by getting involved in the socialist movement, here's a primer on the life and works of this thinker, writer, economist, activist, and revolutionary socialist. So I'm just going to go into one, maybe one more paragraph of this and then leave it up to you, our listeners, to look it up. But again, you're looking at an article by, if you look it up, Simone Norman and Michael Carter from, I think it was the 5th of March this year, called Rosa Luxemburg, Who Was the Revolutionary Socialist and Author? From Teen Vogue, I guess their website. During her, quoting the article again, during her 47 years, Luxembourg was indefatigable in her commitment to building an international proletarian movement and encouraging conditions for global socialism. Her critiques and expansions of Karl Marx's Capital were seminal to the Marxist canon, updating and advancing Marx's earlier theories. Her perpetual revolutionary agitation put a target on her back, but also led to such salient pieces as The Mass Strike, 1906, which used her observations on radical labor strikes across Russia to clarify the conditions for spontaneous class struggle. Well, I don't think there's anything such as purely spontaneous class struggle, but that's another thing. I'm not saying this is the greatest article in the world, but it's really, I think it's quite good. Goes into how capitalist markets would expand through exploitation of indigenous and oppressed populations. We would live through an endless imperial war. Imperialism comes with compound interest. These are subheads. We'd be left with nowhere else to go. End quoting here with Luxembourg rightfully predicted that imperialism would eventually run out of territory to conquer and markets to create and then exploit. Like a snake chasing its tail, imperialism is just capitalism and a militarized monopolistic state going out and conquering the rest of the world for capitalist for reasons of the imperialist powers to expand market share, to exploit cheap labor, etc., to sell stuff. Imperialism's final goal is to swallow itself whole. Even as climate scientists issue increasingly alarming reports about what our future holds, oil and gas giants are clinging to their grip on political power. Though some think that the logical next step is to colonize space as some sort of answer, the final sentence of the accumulation of capital by Luxembourg offers a different solution. According to her, the global crisis and contradiction of capitalism, quote, cannot be solved by any other means than the application of socialism, of the very form of economy that is inherently a universal one and simultaneously a harmonious system in itself since it originated to the satisfaction of the vital needs of laboring humanity.
So does imperialism want to conquer space? And
yes, they do.
They may encounter
yes,
someone more superior?
Yes, they do.
Or something more superior?
Yes, they do. Anyway, again, because of time, very quick here, alert our listeners to a new film by Ken Loach. Ken Loach is a British film director who got his start through the British film industry when it was heavily subsidized in the post-war upswing period by, you know, labor governments put money into the arts and so on. And he made
a lot of good movies,
documentaries for BBC and then started to make dramas. His first movie was called Kes, K-E-S, short for Kestrel. And he made, I think his best film that I've seen is called Land and Freedom, about the Spanish Revolution or Spanish Civil War of the 1930s. And he's made a lot of films.
We got that in our personal library.
Yeah, absolutely. And,
the other one with the Irish Resistance. And,
oh, there's two of them. One was Hidden Agenda, and the other one was called The Rose and the Something or the...
The Barrel?
Barley. I'm sorry. That was a good film, and I can't remember the name of it now.
No,
I'm angry. Angry with myself for not remembering that. So, Ken Loach is now in his 80s, but still making films. His latest film is called Sorry We Missed You. And that's, by the way, the sign that FedEx and Amazon delivery people leave when you're not at home. This is a drama, but it's based on real, the conditions of these delivery drivers working for these hyper-capitalist corporations like UPS,
FedEx,
Amazon, especially Amazon, trying to always lower the amount of delivery time, right? And they want to get the consumers, the buyers of their products, their stuff as soon as possible, to the point where they are just, they don't, it, to the point where it just chews up the workers. They're trying to meet those deadlines.
Yeah.
And that's already happened and happening. It's true of the warehouse workers as well.
A lot of accidents with the UPS trucks trying to get one place to another.
Yeah. And what's really bad on top of that is places like, I don't know about Amazon yet, we will find that out, but places like FedEx, they don't even say to the workers, they exploit the workers without calling them workers for the company. They call them independent contractors. Total lie, total fiction, but legally they're getting away with it. Places have challenged them in court, unions have challenged them. The courts always rule in their favor. So this means they don't have to give any benefits to these workers at all, but they still control them fully and still exploit their labor. And so with FedEx, and as well as the company, this fictional company, I guess, in Britain in the film, the workers have to, they're called independent contractors or something like that in Britain. They're forced to buy their own trucks. Who's got that money? Nobody. Who's got the money for a down payment? Nobody. So they go and they borrow the money usually. And it's like the old miners.
The store?
You owe your soul to the company store. You're always basically paying off debt to the company. So there's two interrelated evils.
The store general manager says, if we ain't got it, you don't need it. Something like that.
This was written, I don't know, I don't remember that, but it sounds right. Written by Paul Lafferty, who has written other films and distributed by Zeitgeist Films. Sorry We Missed You. I'm quoting here from an article by Eric Mann that came out of Counterpunch. Sorry, misuse a powerful exposure of two related evils, capitalism's fraudulent reclassification of workers as independent contractors, like I just mentioned, and its organization of millions of frenzied worker bees driving all over the cities in their own cars and vans, delivering pizzas and packages to a hungry, public. The madness reached scale decades ago with Domino Pizzas promising to deliver in 30 minutes or less, even if its drivers had to kill pedestrians on the way. Now this murderous mania is on steroids, shaped by Jeff Bezos' Amazon's selling Prime memberships that promise two-day delivery, now one-day delivery, same-day delivery by drone, and soon one-hour delivery. Now think what that means about the warehouses, too. You have to have all that stuff sitting in the warehouses ready to go.
So I buy something from Japan, and they say, you get in one hour. Impossible. Is that what you're telling me, that they're gonna
have probably rules about the geographic area, but yeah, you're gonna have one day delivery in some places. I don't think Japan, but maybe, or 1 hour delivery. I don't think Japan at all. Who knows?
There's no more conquered planes.
So this film, Sorry We Missed You, portrays the life of a working class family, which is both heartbreaking and terrifying. What's shown. I don't have time to get into it, but this guy, this will resonate with American audiences, I think. This guy, Ricky, the main character in the film, he's not this perfect guy, right? He's got elements of being a bit sexist, being a bit, trying to create this family environment where he's like the undisputed head, kind of patriarchal. But and this is the part that is really going to be resonate, I think. He thinks he's like the man, He thinks, I can do this. I can do this job. I'll be the best. And the management always likes people like that. They try to get that one or two people that will sacrifice everything, all their personal time and so on, to do the work at what the way management
he's
wants
the go-getter,
it. So they say to him, you don't get hired here, you come on board. We like to call it onboarding. You don't work for us, you work with us. You don't drive for us, you perform services. There's no employment contracts, there's no wages, only fees. There's no clocking in, you become available. Master of your own destiny. Sorts the losers out from the warriors. Now Ricky, at least in the beginning, is thrilled to be a warrior. He's told he has to have his own truck to do the job. He's got to pay for the gas. He's got to pay for the insurance. but he's the boss, quote unquote. This is the same thing to do with FedEx drivers. Now, Ricky's in his late 30s and 40s and already looks exhausted before he's begun. He's had all sorts of other jobs before that. His wife, the traveling healthcare worker, needs the company car, but he wants to sell the company car to have the down payment on the truck because this is going to be their way out, their way into a better living standard. And that title, Sorry We Missed You, turns out they're both working so much that when are they going to see each other? You know, she warns him, his wife, Abby, warns him, look, we'll never see each other. You'll work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week in this new job. You won't see the kids or me. And he says, yes, he answers, but in a year we can have a franchise. His wisecracking, but also wise teenage son replies, oh, great, Dad, a McDonald's? Dad replies, no, smart. I won't say it over the air. No, smart guy. He just thinks this is going to be his way out. I can't tell you how many people I've run into in my life, working class people, that they have schemes and you know they're dead in the water. You know their schemes don't mean anything, but they have that hope, and you can't blame people for having hope, you know?
It's the paper chase.
But it's a hope based on exploitation of others fundamentally. Who's going to take care of the kids when this guy's out doing this stuff, you know? Who's he going to be running over, or who's he going to hire to help him maybe if he gets enough money, if he gets that franchise thing going, whatever. Anyway, it's a really good, it looks like a really good film. I haven't seen it yet, but I'll give you an example of what Ken Loach is like. That's spelled L-O-A-C-H if you want to look him up. He was offered, you know, the Order of British Empire that they give, the royalty in Britain gives to prominent artists and public figures. It's like a, you know, they put the sword on their shoulder and give them a sash or something. And Loach, who's been a lifelong socialist, he explained why he rejected the Order of the British Empire, OBE. He goes, quote, it's all the things I think are despicable. Patronage, deferring to the monarchy, and the name of the British Empire itself, which is a monument to exploitation and conquest. I turned down the OBE because it's not a club you want to join when you look at the villains who've got it.
Wow, I like that. Yes.
Yes, Ken Loach.
Stick to your guns.
Hey, there's this article also from Counterpunch called The Neoliberal Plague by Rob Urey from March 6, 2020. And again, we're not going to have time to do the article justice. We're just going to refer to it and mention a couple things. He goes, this is an interesting introduction. You see a picture of a book cover called La Peste, which is French for the plague. Remember Albert Camus, a famous existentialist influenced by socialism to a certain extent, he wrote a book called The Plague, where disparate lives are brought together during a plague that sweeps through an Algerian city. Today, by the way of the emergence of a lethal and highly communicable virus, coronavirus, we, the people of the West, have an opportunity to reconsider what we mean to one another. The existential lesson is that through dread and angst, we can choose to live with responsibilities that choice entails or just fade away. Through the virus, a new light is being shown on 4 decades, and I would go back further, but whatever, of neoliberal or capitalist reorganization of the political economy. The combination of widespread economic marginalization and a lack of paid time off means that the sick and highly contagious workers will have little economic choice but to spread the virus. And the insurance company pricing mechanism intended to dissuade people from overusing healthcare, skin in the game, quote unquote, means that only very sick people will buy, quote unquote, healthcare they can't afford. This is what we were talking about earlier. Does this ring a bell, the hospital situation?
Oh, yeah.
Market provision of virus test kits, vaccines, and basic sanitary will, in the absence of government coercion, follow a monopolist model of underprovision at prices that are unaffordable for most people. That's already started to happen. They did do that $8.5 billion, that some of that's supposed to go to a vaccine and some other stuff. We'll see if that really comes through or not. So the government is, even in the capitalist, you know, America, and even under Trumpo, they were forced, you know, by the fear of anger of the working class and masses of people to cough up some money. But they should have done that immediately. It should have been a lot more. Still should be a lot more. And what does he say? He says something interesting. He gets in the the most fiscally responsible route, in the sense of assuring that the rich don't pay taxes, is to let those who can't afford health care to die. That's the logic of capitalism, the illogic, the evil of it. If these means that tens of millions of people die necessarily, markets are a harsh taskmaster. You had 3.4% mortality rate at three times the contagion rate of the Spanish flu, and I can't make sense of that figure that he puts out there. But anyway, he says if this last part, this figure and mortality rate and all that, reads like Ayn Randian social theory as interpreted by a budding sociopath in the basement of his dead parents' crumbling tract home, is basic neoliberal ideology applied to circumstances that we can see playing out in real time. According to Ryan Grimm of The Intercept, Bill Clinton eliminated the reasonable pricing policy for drugs. Bill Clinton and the Democrats, the reasonable pricing, quote-unquote, requirement for drugs made by companies that receive government funding. This is bearing on both commercial availability, commercially developed coronavirus test kits, and any vaccines that might be developed. So anyway, this is a really good, I think, analysis from what I've read. I skimmed it before the show, of basically taking some socialist-influenced ideas and methods and applying it to what's happening right now. Here he gets into Obamacare. He goes, when Obamacare was passed, the U.S. Had the worst healthcare outcomes among rich countries. 10 years later, the U.S. has the worst healthcare income among rich countries. And medical bankruptcies are virtually unchanged since Obamacare was passed. Now, the Democrats are all saying Obamacare is just great and we'll do the public option, you know? Sanders is calling for Medicare for all, but he does defend Obamacare as well. I don't see him really criticizing Obamacare that much. Now, the reason for focusing on Obamacare in this article is it is the system through which we encounter the coronavirus. In the narrow political sense of getting a healthcare bill passed, Obamacare may or may not have been pragmatic, quote-unquote, but in a public healthcare sense, it's a disaster, decades in the making. The problem wasn't or isn't Obama per se. It's the radical ideology of capitalism behind it that was posed as pragmatism. And Mr. Obama's success was to get a bill passed, a political accomplishment. It was not to create a functioning healthcare system. So anyway, check that out. Rob Urey, neoliberal plague, capitalist plague, and that's from Counterpunch, March 6, 2020, the neoliberal plague. Hey, we're definitely running out of time now. Just want to say that in Worcester, where I do a lot of political organizing, there's one of these new cannabis companies is going to open up. Even before it's open, and where it's grown in Holliston, apparently, they are doing the workers
farm?
Are organizing.
Is that farm?
I don't know where. But the workers are organizing, and the facilities in Boston and Holliston with UFCW Local 1445, and in Worcester, where the shop is supposed to open up as well, and so. You know, people, I remember a lot of these before marijuana was decriminalized to a certain extent in Massachusetts. There was this idea that being pro-pot means you're progressive or something. Never was really the case. Here we have the pot company fighting the unionization. Circulated a letter, the pot company circulated a letter to the workers from joining the union. Lies basically about the union drive. And I don't know. It's really just they go into the letter. You could be. This is such like boilerplate anti-union stuff. I find it funny, even though it's people tend to believe it. It says, for example, you may be approached by a paid union organizer. Most are not paid, by the way, or one of your coworkers that is in favor of organizing a union. The union organizer may ask you to sign a union authorization card. Signing these cards has serious consequences. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Serious as in good. Anyways, that letter was unfair, according to labor law, illegal interference in a union drive. Companies get away with that stuff all the time, but, you know, the union is pointing it out, UFCW. Anyway, so it's workers at Mayflower Medicinals. And I think that's the name of it. We'll update people on that. It's a Ianthus Capital Holding is the parent company. So already they're monopolizing these little pot things are really big business and they're getting monopolized, you know? Quick other tidbit before we have to go. If you're the Teamsters Union, very powerful, potentially very, very powerful union, important union. A lot of, like we were just talking about UPS, those are represented, those workers are represented by the Teamsters Union. This guy, James P. Hoffa, the son of the more well-known Hoffa Sr., who was killed by the mafia, most likely. And by the way, all the ideas about the Teamsters Union being under the control of organized crime were widely exaggerated. There was some connection there, which, as we've explained before on the show, existed between... Hoffa was trying to shortcut of using Teamster, in some cases, some limited cases, using Teamster... mafia violence to try to get companies that were trying to hurt the union off their back. Stupid thing to do. He mobilized the membership, and it came back to haunt him. Also, the mafia was looking for a place to launder money. Teamsters had a big pension fund. So there was some overlap in some locals in some places, but mostly the Teamsters were not involved in any kind of organized crime stuff. Hoffa paid for it with his life. Now his son has been in power, and he just did this horrible contract for UPS workers that people were really angry about, where the majority of the workers voted against it, but he invoked some little clause in the bylaws of the union, which is still pretty democratic overall, but he found some little bylaws that said you need a certain percentage above just a majority, like two-thirds or something. So he pushed through the agreement over the heads of the workers, and the workers were pissed off. And now he's retiring, which is really good. That doesn't mean that his whole business unionist philosophy will disappear, but there is a race shaping up between Hoffa-backed, called the Verma slate, because Verma is the secretary treasurer of the Denver local, with a guy from Boston, Sean O'Brien, Local 25. And so because Hoffa's resigning, and I'm not sure when the election will be, but probably coming up soon, we'll have more on that. Remember last time we were talking about free bus service?
In Worcester?
Yeah. And I said if we found examples of, well, we're fighting for that. It hasn't happened yet. We're fighting for...
mini rails? And
yeah, looking for light rail examples. I came across one. Austin, Texas. You been there?
I've been there before, and I know that Houston already got a metro.
A light rail? Like train?
No.
Tramway?
Metro, like us. Better than us.
Subway?
Subway.
Nice. I didn't know that.
Yeah, connections. Yeah, I didn't know that until I went a couple years.
Yeah. Well, here they are calling for. It looks like they already might have a bit of a light rail system in Austin, and I bet they would have a bus system, obviously. But what they're calling for here is a downtown subway system and a massive multi-billion-dollar expansion of light rail, or perhaps making light rail for the first time. It was unclear to me in reading this. So they're calling for this. People that work for this CAP Metro, they call it, in Austin, Texas, creating a light rail system that includes a downtown subway system, underground city tunnels, at least one new bridge, etc., and multi-billion dollars. True to the corporate media, they focus on the costs before the benefits, so-called costs. But the fact that it's happening at all is what I wanted to point out. I think this is a thing occurring to more and more people, combination of mass transit and cars getting really expensive for people to get anywhere, but also the climate stuff. If you're serious about the environment, you got to be for mass transit like this.
Especially Texas is so large.
Yep, exactly.
You get everywhere. In Dallas, you need a car to go from point A to point B.
Well, there was serious talk about high-speed rail. In California and Texas first, mm-hmm. and then somebody, I don't know, the Trump administration or something, acts that. That's got to be fought for. That should be fought for by the labor movement. I mean, one thing happening in Worcester is, I don't know what the position of the bus drivers union is there, transit workers union. We were out helping them on the picket line and stuff, and I just haven't heard anything about what they feel about free fare. They should be on the forefront. They should be like, yeah, we're for free fare. Because part of the demands are you don't lay anybody off to implement it, you know. Yeah. So we had a lot of other stuff about the elections, and next time we meet, there'll be the next round of primaries will be happening. So we'll definitely get into it next time. Sorry we didn't have time today to get into. One thing I could say that was interesting I found is that we try to we try to be honest with people and say exactly what Bernie Sanders is up to. He's not a socialist, really. He's putting forward some good demands, his campaign, raising expectations, which are good things. But he's going through the Democratic Party. He should break with the Democrats and help build a workers' party with those same demands and even expanded demands. One thing that, since a lot of people we know are trying to say, well, Sanders really isn't part of the Democratic Party, all that, but he is, really. Listen to this. Bernie Sanders embraces Obama for the first time in a new ad. And it's a whole article. It's appeared in a few different places, LA Times, and I got this from CNN, where he's going to start doing TV ads where he makes it look like Obama supports him. It's a little more complicated than that, than Obama's really, in terms of Obama really supporting him or not. Trying to be more like mainstream and all that.
Oh, when Mike Bloomberg did the same thing with his first advertisement.
I know.
He got Obama.
But Bloomberg
there.
Doesn't claim
when,
to be.
When I was mayor.
Bloomberg doesn't claim to be a maverick. Mm-hmm. You know, like Sanders claim, I'm going to be the organizer in chief. I'm going to do this and that. The reality is, I just got a thing from his group, Our Revolution. I'm on their mailing list. He's endorsing like 6 or 7 Democrats this, like, last week. I mean, this guy's part of the Democratic Party. Sorry to burst your bubble out there. But, you know, he could save himself and the movement, and if he really believes in those demands, by breaking with the Democrats and forming a workers' party. And the basis is there for that, but right now he's just using all that support as an electoral movement, and he's sending signals he's going to back down. He's going to support Biden, like he's been saying all along. If Biden gets it, he's going to not contest the convention if there's a plurality or majority in favor of a split or a majority in favor of Biden. And he's doing these ads with Obama. You know, why would someone that believes in Medicare for All do an ad linking himself to Obama, who did Obamacare? Anyway, we're out of time. Thanks for listening. Last words, Diego?
Power to the people, like always. And happy Women's Day.
International Women's Day. Yeah, if you listen to the first part of the program, we were all about International Women's Today. We could come back to that next time as well.
Yeah. I'm going to get roses for my mother now.
Cool, yeah. Bread and roses. Take care, everybody.
This is not the burial, it's the resurrection. Hey, kids, gather around.
Oh, no, yeah. Swearing. Although it's a good song.
I put my hand into the
White Clef's in that. That's the White Clef.
I felt the pain as it started to burn.
That's the one he goes like,
the same
if I became
all
president.